Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
I think I'm just like a little bit nervous. That's why I'm.
No,
like,
I know.
That's
why I'm. I know. It feels weird. It feels weird.
Welcome to Still Counting. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Claire Malone.
And I'm Nate Silver. And we're talking too fast because it's the first episode and we're a little nervous.
I also read my name. I was like, I'm Claire Malone.
And this is our first official episode. Yes, we did a Freed Warmer. Yes, we talked to Pod Save America. But this is it, folks. From now on Wednesday evening, you're going to get a Still Counting podcast episode in your feed. And so for, you know, first I'll say this is what we're going to do on today's podcast. We're going to do a midterms extravaganza. We're even going to kind of play a game. We're also going to talk about sort of the past year plus in Republican voter sentiment. It's been a pretty topsy-turvy year for the Trump coalition. We're going to talk about the convention and all that jazz, the anniversary of Charlie Kirk's death. Before we get into everything that we have to cover today, though, we should say, welcome back, everybody.
Yeah.
To our past listeners. Spread the word.
Welcome to the new people. Hopefully, if you have no idea who we are, really, welcome to Still Counting.
Well, actually, Claire, who are we?
Who are we? I'm Claire Malone, I'm Claire. The script says. We all worked together at a data site called 538, and I was hired by Nate to be like the normal magazine reporter.
To be normal.
I was hired by Nate to be normal, to be like a magazine reporter person. And then I'm sort of a traditional reporter. I am a writer at The New Yorker. I cover media and politics there, and I am currently on book leave for the year. Actually going back in like 6 months, and I'm writing a book about the MAHA movement. That's who I am.
Nate, who are you?
I'm Claire Malone. That's what it says in the script. Yeah, so my trajectory into journalism, if that's what you want to call it, is highly non-traditional. Before I ever like got into journalism, I was an online poker player. I was building baseball models. Basically, 2008 comes along. I'm living in Chicago. This campus hipster, as I thought of him, named Barack Obama, decides to run for president. It was a very exciting time in politics, and also a time when there had been in baseball and in sports a lot of talk about analytics. This was a kind of money ball revolution, so to speak. I was getting a little burned out with the baseball stuff. The poker was not going super well, to be honest. And so started trying to build a forecasting model, first for the Democratic primary in 2008 and then general election. And it just kind of improbably took off. But yeah, I try to look at the world. I sometimes do reporting, but I'm looking at this.
He's written two books.
I've written two. For the books, I do actually do real reporting.
For the books,
which,
I do.
Which for the most recent book involved hanging out in Las Vegas playing poker for a year.
I spent a lot of time in Vegas.
Nate,
yeah,
basically lives.
It was a nice excuse. Silicon Valley, Miami. But like, I don't do a lot of insider gossip with, oh, what's the scoop about the internal polls in New Hampshire? Like, I think that is actually a waste of time. You're being spun a lot of time. I think the goal of a model, we talked about this on the Pod Save trailer, it's to force yourself to be more rigorous in analyzing the news.
And
right?
Explaining how you view the world.
And now, and Nate had he started 538, which was at the New York Times, then it moved to ESPN, then they closed it, yada, yada, yada. Now he has a wonderfully
Silver Bulletin, which is at natesilver.net. But like, we got Flipper is our midterms model. We got LA, our NFL
today.
Model.
Yeah. Okay, I will do a briefer. Who am I? I was hired by Nate at 538.
Not in the Less Weirdness Initiative, I'll tell you that much.
I was hired to be a podcast twink at 538.
We were hired at about the same time.
Yes, we were.
You came from Wisconsin.
I came from straight from Wisconsin Public Radio, which at the time I could not have imagined how good of an education Wisconsin would have given me for what was to come in American politics.
My earring just fell out.
Earring?
Well,
things
folks
are going incredibly well. Anyway, I stuck around 538 for about a decade, where I did basically a combination of field reporting analysis, looking at the data, did things like the gerrymandering project. And once 538 shut down, I started GD Politics, which is a podcast that I host on Mondays and Thursdays, talking to a bunch of people who are journalists, authors, sometimes politicians, pollsters who look at data and try to make sense of it all. And I'm going to try to take some of that knowledge that I get from all the people I talk to and bring it to folks here as well. But anyway, enough of that, enough throat clearing. Let's dive into what's on hand today. But first, let me just say, dear listeners, and for our YouTube audience, I'm looking straight to camera for this one. Previous listeners, new listeners alike, spread the word. Subscribe on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, rate and review us. Like, I don't know exactly how the algorithm works. That's Nate's job. But apparently, on Apple Podcasts, the more you rate and review us, the higher up we go and the more people see us. And then we'll maybe get introduced to the podcast. Basically, we're out here trying to rebuild an audience. And it's like a political campaign. It's going to take all of us.
Yes. Okay.
See, Claire and I would never do that, right? That's why you're a good hire.
We're like, do our dirty work, Galen.
The podcast twunk now. Okay. We are officially post-Labor Day.
I almost wore a white suit coat this morning, which, first of all, wouldn't have looked.
Claire.
Would have popped on.
You're a Condé Nast employee. You must not be wearing white after Labor Day.
It's an old school rule.
So, yes, we are post-Labor Day, which is officially when we stop wearing white, when we go back to school. It is also, historically, when people begin to tune into the election cycle in our highly polarized and partisan and engaged environment. I think people pay attention a little bit sooner than that. But nonetheless, we are going to use that as an opportunity to dive into the midterm. So right now, Nate, your model, named Flipper, suggests that Democrats have an 83% chance of winning the House. And the Senate forecast is split exactly 50-50. Mm-hmm. Now, did you design the forecast that way to build suspense at the start of election season? No, I'm kidding. So when you first launched, the Senate favored Democrats.
Slightly,
not overwhelmingly, but I think it peaked at about 58% less than a month ago in terms of Democrats' likelihood of taking the Senate. What has happened between then and now?
So a couple of things have happened. Number one, people get really sensitive about like 50 versus 55 versus 57. It's not a big deal. It's like in an NBA game, it's like 1 point being scored or 2 points being scored to take it from Knicks ahead by a point to the Raptors ahead by a point or whatever else. So when you're near 50-50, small moves affect the probabilities a fair bit. That's getting a little technical. There are a couple of things that have happened. One is that we've started to get more polls among likely voters. And not just registered voters. And that matters because turnout is relatively low in midterms, higher than it used to be. But as our model's been adjusting to those, earlier in the cycle, it felt like there was a bigger, didn't feel like, I guess, I don't know if it has feelings. I guess we use AI, right? Maybe
it has feelings. Anthropomorphizing models, Nate.
I used to be an anti-anthropomorphizer, and now it's just you say, oh, the model thinks. Anyway, as we've gotten more generic ballot polls among likely voters. They don't show quite as much of an enthusiasm gap. I mean, I'm being too technical.
Now I'm just, by the way, now I'm just thinking about whether or not you think the model could ever kill you per discussions on Twitter
about AI.
I
switched from Claude to ChatGPT in the middle
because
of
it was
Flipper.
Trying to kill you?
The Claude opuses were kind of weird, right? They would they'd be quite stubborn and lazy.
What is a Claude opus? I don't use
full range of AI use here, which is like Nate has at least 12 AI employees. I use AI regularly, but like don't make it code for me. You don't use AI.
I do not use AI. I don't know what an opus
is. But here's a summary version, right? As we get closer to the election, I think you see like a little bit of a rebound in Republican enthusiasm. It's having a marginal effect on the numbers and some of these kind of less polled races in the generic ballot. Look, Trump's approval rating is 38% or so. His disapproval rating is 58, 59%. He's not very popular, but Democrats aren't that popular either. So I think you might be seeing just the slightest bit of reversion to the mean. But there's lots of layers in Flipper. There are expert forecasts. You know, is New Hampshire now a state that's in play? How realistically do we take Tallarico's? You know, the model says Tallarico is a slight favorite in Texas. Do we buy that or not?
All of these states. Okay. And we're even going to get into Trump's popularity and his coalition and whatnot. But first, we're going to play a little game. I mean, not first. We're going to play a little game in order to talk about all of these states.
But it's educational.
Don't worry not. a little game, which is we're going to draw the most competitive Senate races out of a hat. And that's most competitive according to the polling averages. And that means that we don't know the order that we're going to talk about them in.
It's the state of the race in Gamified.
Yes, exactly. Form. And I will say, I have a GD Politics hat here, which is only because because I'm a shameless shill. And also because we don't have Still Counting merch yet. But I hear it's coming. I hope it's coming. I think it's coming.
I think it's coming.
You know, Nate, you got to stop advertising. I mean, we all love the Knicks. We live in New York City, but you got to stop advertising the Knicks for free on this
We're
podcast.
Getting silver bulletin hats. By the way, I'm happy to advertise the Knicks, you know, as long as Dolan doesn't kick me out of.
Okay. Claire, you are first.
Okay.
So pick a race out of the
hat. By the way, last night in preparation for talking about all of the Senate races, I think I watched ads for every single Senate candidate, or most of them, just to kind of get a flavor. I was like, I want to see, like,
what's... Did it make you feel more optimistic or more pessimistic about American politics?
Well, I have to say, it was quite pessimistic. Like, that was after watching, like, you know, kind of close to, like, 40 minutes of just, like, you know...
Dun, dun, dun. Like...
It's Well, none of these people have ever been to Washington, D.C. it was basically all about, like, how much beef costs and isn't it terrible and insurance companies. And that was both parties. It was like, yeah, it was quite striking how bleak it was. Anyhow. Okay, I picked North Carolina, which is a bad pick. it's definitely a bad pick. It's a bad pick because we're pretty sure that the Democrat Roy Cooper is going to win in his race against Republican Michael Whatley. Roy Cooper, and that win probability, according to Flipper, trademark Nate Silver.
It's pronounced with a dolphin. It's like Flipper. It's the official.
How did you name it?
We've already had a problem with furries and the 538 Politics podcast brand. We really don't need to give them any fodder.
How did you name it, Flipper?
R's are good because, like, R is for regression or, like...
I don't even want to know. Okay, so... But Flipper gives the Democratic win probability at 86.9 percentage points.
Let's put it like this. It's not a sure thing that Cooper wins in North Carolina.
But it would be embarrassing.
But if
he
doesn't, Democrats are fucked anyway. That means the polls are probably way off again. They need four seats. By the way, Galen, you're saying, well, 50-50, is that just a cop-out? It's kind of a coincidence because, like, we think it's going to be, and everyone thinks it's going to be a very Democratic year, but they have to win four seats, two of which are in quite red states. North Carolina is not a quite red state. It's a slightly red state. Like, we have in your handwriting is actually better than I thought, Galen.
So this is Saul.
This is Saul.
This is producer Saul. Well, we're introducing producer Saul, who has, in Nate's reading, pretty good handwriting. And I would agree with that.
That's the only job that might survive the AI apocalypse is, like, good handwriting. It's rare.
What you were going to say is that Trump won North Carolina by 3 points in 2024, which is a slightly red state.
And Harris only... He only won the whole thing by 1.5 point, right? So North Carolina actually moved toward the tipping point. It was one of the few positives out of Kamala Harris's night in November 2024 was that North Carolina actually became more purple. And Cooper's a strong candidate. He's the former governor. If he weren't to win, then it means the polls were way off again.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of overall trends to look at, I think an interesting one here is that we've all been talking about the anti-establishment sentiment amongst the electorate this go-round. Roy Cooper is, like, a two-term governor.
Good candidate, like, well-known in the state.
But he is, I mean, he's not really the establishment because he's running against the Democratic Party in part. And he's like, you know, I don't belong to anybody. I'm my own man. He's very much been a feature of state politics and not national politics. And so I think...
The benefit of being a governor.
Suggest that he is a good candidate to run in North Carolina, but he's not running. You know, the Republican Michael Whatley is not really a populist outsider who can say the establishment has sort of taken the country in the wrong direction, whatever. He's like the former chair of the Republican Party in North Carolina. So I think whereas maybe being so entrenched in politics could have been a vulnerability, the contours of this race are not going to let us see that.
Great. So takeaway is panic at the disco for Democrats if Roy Cooper loses. Still Counting is brought to you by Sundays. We are what we eat, and so are our dogs. A long, healthy, active life starts with clean, real food nutrition every day. Sundays for Dogs is different. It's human grade, real food you'd feel good eating yourself. Sunday's recipes contain 80% plus all natural meat. That's about twice the meat content of some leading frozen brands. Ooh. Plus ingredients like kale, ginger, and blueberries. No fillers, no chemicals, just simple, complete nutrition. Doesn't even look or smell like dog food. It looks like high-quality jerky. Do you eat jerky?
They're really selling us on, like, actually eating our dog food here. Which, I mean, if that's a measure of, you know, the quality, I think.
Should we say here that none of us own dogs?
But we know dogs. We've met dogs.
We have met dogs. We have met dogs.
I have a stuffed animal or two.
Nate. Wait, Nate. Do the stats live for us. According to my search right now, 45% of American households have dogs. What's the likelihood that you would get three separate households together and none of us would have dogs?
One in six or one in seven, roughly. But that assumes things are uncorrelated. I mean, I would guess the dog ownership rate's lower in New York.
Yeah. Well, can I tell you something? This Sundays for Dogs is vet-founded and vet-formulated, created by Dr. Tori Waxman, who I'm betting owns a dog, to meet her high standards as both a veterinarian and a dog parent. Yes, she is a dog parent. Do you guys want to know the best part?
Yes.
It's effortless. Mm-hmm. No fridge, no freezer, no prep, no mess. Just scoop and serve. Over 100,000 dogs are now eating Sundays, and many dog parents notice the same things. Shinier coats, better digestion, more energy, and finally getting excited at mealtime, even the pickiest eaters.
And you know, those dogs can be, some of them are picky eaters. I used to have a roommate who had a dog at Memphis.
A dog I've met.
Shout out Memphis, a Bernese Mountain Dog. Super picky, but I bet Memphis would have eaten Sundays.
Well, you too can make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/count and get 50% off your first order. Or you can use code COUNT at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaysfordogs.com/count. sundaysfordogs.com/count or use code COUNT at checkout.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Nate, next race that you're picking out of the hat.
Okay.
Second pick.
Dig in there. Of course. Is this right? Michigan.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dramatic pick.
Abdul El-Sayed leads by roughly 2 points in the Silver Bulletin polling average. Does not include, by the way, a new Glengariff poll, I don't think, that came out last night after a publication deadline that might cut it down to one or one and a half. Look, we've talked a lot about Michigan. If you haven't listened to any of the preview episodes,
we were on Pod Save America talking about the Michigan race.
The basic lay of the land is something like this. Michigan is about as purple as it gets. It almost exactly follows the national trend. The national trend this year is around D+7, meaning in the average state, if you count up all the votes for all 435 House races, you'd expect Democrats to win by about 7. Michigan, therefore, is also about a +7. The question is, can El-Sayed be a quote-unquote bad enough candidate? I'll explain what I mean by that, right? Or Mike Rogers a quote-unquote good enough candidate to overcome that 7-point spread? Now, the different ways to define bad candidate, when a certain type of election nerd like me means that, it just means they're likely to underperform the baseline. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. It doesn't mean that I don't like their ideas.
They're not charismatic or, yeah.
And there's a lot of research that I think people are in some degree of denial about that says, in general, more moderate candidates, how you define moderation is complicated, tend to overperform.
And moderation, we should say, just complicated to define it, can often be affected by gender, race, things like that.
Absolutely. It's interesting, by the way, that El-Sayed is kind of like playing in to this kind of almost like fuckboy image, right? It's like, oh yeah, I like women. I like, you know, it's like, he's not like.
I think it's more like he lifts, right?
He lifts.
Like
he lifts. So he's raised a lot of money. He inspires a lot of young voters. He also turns off a lot of voters. And but, you know, here's the thing. Even if you believe, and we do, that moderation, hard to define, probably helps, we also understand that polarization is driving everything. And actually, voters are pretty smart, right? Voters might say, I understand that Mike Rogers might come across as moderate, but empirically, he's going to vote with Trump the large majority of the time. And El Sayed will probably vote with Democrats the large majority of the time. And we're kind of moving into a parliamentary system where the candidates matter less. So in a model, you might say, okay, there's like a 3 or 4 point penalty here. A 7 point cushion is enough to cover it. In the polls, there's for now a little bit more of a penalty. It's closer to a toss-up, maybe El Sayed by 1 point than plus
and,
seven.
And by the way, in my tour of candidate ads last night, I mean, I actually think the way that El Sayed is kind of trying to present himself to general election voters is not moderating on the issues, right? Yeah. Which is I think kind of, you know, key for his campaign, right? He's running a real, like, true believers Medicare for all plan in some ways. He's not actually a democratic socialist, but I think he's sort of running the Elizabeth Warren playbook where it's like, I'm Uh-oh. A progressive. No, hold on. Wait, let me finish my thought, which is like, I'm a progressive, but like, don't worry, I'm not here to tear down capitalism. Like, that was her thing. But I think where he is, where you see him trying to quote unquote moderate is on that perception of him as an extremist, right? So like, he has a lot of stuff about, like, he has the ad with his grandparents. He has the ad about, like, I grew up playing football in Michigan. Like, I feel obligated as a Ohioan to say Muck Michigan, but like that stuff.
Was that one planned?
It wasn't. It just came to me. But that's where he's trying to moderate on is the perception, well, right? Like of him as the like scary
which
foreigner,
is
right? Which by the way, Mike Rogers is playing into by like saying like Abdul Rahman, and you know, so there's interesting dynamics about what we mean as a moderate candidate there.
Yeah, I'll say as somebody who got some blowback from in the comments after we were on
Never read the comments,
America,
man.
Because I had described El Sayed as a below average candidate, yeah. More liable to perform below where a quote unquote generic Democrat is. I was really talking about the numbers
right.
And the perception of El Sayed as an extreme candidate. And I think like people interpreted that all to be about Israel, because yeah. That's kind of where a lot of the comments are, sort of, I guess, in the left space online. But I really don't actually think, as much as that has been a sort of knockdown, drag-out fight for the Democratic Party, what is going to decide this race? I think the most important thing, that, like my takeaway for the Michigan race, is that it is a very high-profile test for progressives, for the activist left. You said he hasn't moderated that much. I will say, on issues like, and I think issues like defund the police, abolish ICE, Medicare for all, those kinds of things will actually motivate voters more than the Israel question.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are the, for example, healthcare, safety, cost of goods, corruption, those are the kinds of things that are motivating voters in this election. I mean, I looked through all of the polling and really, like, the Israel-Palestine question, as much as it may motivate activists, for the broad sort of base of American voters, it is not ranking up there. It's really, again, inflation, sort of incompetence in government and corruption, then, well, the economy more broadly.
Data centers, flock cameras, well, like these are local issues that are actually—
And the war in Iran, like the yeah. war, when you ask people, like, what's very important to you, 50% of voters say the war in Iran, 22% of voters say the Israel-Gaza issue. So I think, I just want to say here that, like, when this battle plays out sort of in the general election mm-hmm. in Michigan for Senate, I think that the test is going to be, so he has pivoted away from defund the police. He has not pivoted away from abolish ICE. He's pivoted a little on healthcare, where he wrote a book with the sort of prologue written mm-hmm. by Bernie Sanders about Medicare for all. He said, you know, I don't want to abolish private insurance. Those things can coexist, et cetera. And so I think that this is going to be viewed as a test for whether the left can perform in a battleground state ahead of what's going to be also a knockdown, drag-out fight in the 2028 Democratic primaries.
Look at we got the most boring and the most controversial in the first two picks.
He is a former podcaster.
Yeah, wait, at Crooked Media, right?
At Crooked Media.
A recovering podcaster, that might be too much to overcome, I think.
Yeah, well, wait. This is amazing because polling groups have asked Americans what are the most attractive and least attractive traits for a candidate at, you know, these kind of strategy groups. Can you guess what one of the least attractive traits for a candidate is?
Well, now I know.
Podcast host.
We can never run.
And
from.
Well, socialist was also one of them. He said, again, he is not DSA, although he sort of is seen oftentimes with AOC and Bernie Sanders and people who align with the yeah. the.
Yeah, I don't think you realize it. It's like a sake. You can't pour your own
here,
sake.
I'll hold
it's
it for considered... you.
Okay, all right, thank you.
What is that? That's some rich bitch stuff you just said. What is that?
Okay, I got Iowa, which is Josh Turk, the Democrat, versus Ashley Hinson. Currently in the polling average, Hinson leads by 1.3 points. Republicans have a win probability of 65%. To be clear, Trump won Iowa in 2024 by 13 points.
Can I give you a funny before you do your...
Please do.
Again, in my tour of watching all these ads, so we're obviously, you know, talking about the difficult thing about this midterm, which we'll talk about a little bit more in later in the episode, is Trump sort of being like, pretend like I am on the ballot and a vote for me, when a lot of Republicans are obviously trying to distance themselves from him because of Iran, things like that. And Ashley Hinson has a very funny campaign ad where it's totally like, it's like, you know, her just doing the kind of like around the state. And then there's just like a flash for a second, a picture of Trump. And it's almost like someone at the last minute was like, we got to add him. So it's just like, it's like a dash of Trump. And then you go back to like the Ashley Hinson Iowa stuff. It's a perfect visual metaphor for the line that Republicans are trying to walk.
Which is tricky because right in this midterm cycle, Republicans want to turn out low propensity MAGA voters who show up when Trump is on the top of the ballot.
Not
in
midterm,
presidential
not in midterm
election,
years. Yeah.
Have historically not showed up in midterm years. But at the same time, if you want to talk about a state that should be just like fully in the Republican coalition, almost no questions asked, but has seen some vulnerabilities for the party, you have to talk about Iowa. Again, went for Trump by 13 percentage points. It is a relatively rural, relatively white state, a part of the electorate that Republicans have done very well with. But looking at polling work that friend of the pod, Mary Radcliffe, has done, amongst rural voters, if you look at generic ballot polling from when Trump took office to now, Republicans have cut their advantage in half. So Republicans had a 26-point advantage with rural voters when Trump took office. It's now 13-point advantage.
If you believe that.
Because
I'm not a big cross-tab driver.
Again,
David,
there have been some problems with this kind of polling in the past, particularly in, well, around presidential and midterm elections.
Okay,
where,
caveat
like,
emptor.
The kinds of rural voters yes. who are showing up in the polls right now are more likely to vote for Democrats anyway, et cetera, et cetera. But if the polling is to be believed, this and there are some explanations as well, like the tariffs are not particularly sort of going well for an agriculturally based economy in part. And so there is both you see some data suggestion and you also see some narrative reasons for vulnerability. Also, we've already gotten into some like candidate quality issues on the map this cycle. Iowa is a place where like there are not any candidates facing real like challenges in terms of quality, like not. We don't have a Ken Paxton on the ticket. We don't have like a Susan Collins who way overperforms.
Yeah.
It is more generic candidates, if you will. And I mean, Rob Sand might sort of. They all have good stories.
Yeah, Josh Turek is a Paralympian, basketball player. I think he won a couple medals.
A couple years ago.
So like that's a good, you know, like and his.
But we don't have any.
Do you know any gold medals?
Proven. We don't have any proven electoral juggernauts on the ballot. Anyway.
Well, Rob Sand, former fashion model, Rob Sand, by the way. Whenever the ads are like, he's a former fashion model, it's like, oh, you don't really have a lot to work with here, right? He used to be very good looking, or is.
Wait, like, yeah, it's like, you can't go with socialist, so you go with former fashion
model. No, that's
model.
Right. Iowa is the closest thing to like a generic D versus generic R. And so, therefore, as that generic number has slipped just a little bit, for Democrats, Iowa's moved with it. So when we launched Flipper, it was kind of toss up to tilt R. Now we'd call it lean R. I mean, 2-1 is more than a tilt, I'd say. But Iowa to me is like the benchmark for Democrats had a great night, right? I'm not sure it's a tipping point as much as like Texas, where you do have a severe candidate quality issue, or Alaska, which is its own drummer. We'll talk about that in a minute. But like If Iowa falls, that means Trump deeply fucked up.
Okay, we were planning on going through 9 of the most competitive races according to the polling averages. I think at this point it would take us about 3 hours. And although we all have the speaking stamina, I don't know that the audience has the patience. So we are going to go to a speed round. We're going to put 1 minute on the clock for each of the remaining races. Worry not, listeners. We will get in more in depth into these races in the future. But all right, 60 seconds. Let's see if we can do it. And Claire, you're first up.
Okay, I got Ohio. Brown versus Husted in the Senate race. Sherrod Brown versus John Husted. Win probability for Sherrod Brown is at 61.4%, according to Flipper. I mean, interesting one. Sherrod Brown is a former senator. He's got a really gravelly voice people love.
So rude to make the Ohioan do this in just a minute.
On the gubernatorial side, do we want to do that? Or no, should I? No, we shouldn't do that at all. But no, candidate quality-wise, I think Sherrod Brown is an interesting Democrat. He's also...
You can talk this fast, Claire.
I can talk this fast. He's also a older white guy who has a more moderate stance on Israel. So he doesn't have any of those like party controversies that you see in Michigan, which used to be sort of like swing together state. That's all I got. Go,
Nate. He won in 2018, which is a similar year to this one. People like Democrats could win these for the red states. They won in Montana. They won in Ohio and even West Virginia in 2018.
Okay.
We have 10 seconds left. And all I'm going to say is, yes, he lost in his last Senate race, but he outperformed Kamala Harris by 8 points. And if you add that together with the blue environment this time around,
beep, 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 beep.
Okay.
Nice. Okay, good. Is Nate next?
Yes, Nate is next.
Can't pull your own sake.
Okay, start. Go for it. Nate, you got to go. We're on the clock.
Texas, I'm getting the easy ones. James Tallarico against Ken Paxton. Look, the number I point to first here is our friend, actually not our friend, Beto O'Rourke. Beto. Who lost by
45 seconds.
You guys are intentionally delaying me. 15 seconds.
2018, the best anchor year for this midterm, Trump's first midterm. Beto O'Rourke lost by 2.5 points to Ted Cruz. The question is basically, can Ken Paxton be a worse candidate than Ted Cruz to the point where you make up that 2.5 point deficit? You have not particularly seen since 2018 favorable demographic trends for Democrats in Texas. You saw great trends in the suburbs.
20 seconds.
For Democrats, you saw South Texas reverting more red. Do people think that Tallarico is a Hispanic name? That's one question that I have. Galen, okay, you guys, what do you think?
I think
Google
that...
did Ken Paxton steal a pen, and that speaks to candidate quality.
And we are at time.
Great. Okay.
Still Counting is brought to you by Incogni. Let's talk about something that doesn't get enough attention. Corporations profiting off your personal data without your consent.
Boo.
Boo.
Yeah.
I mean, boo. Bad use of data.
Bad use of data.
No, man, we just trust all these giant corporations. They know everything about us. They could steal all my intellectual property. I don't even put secrets in email, really. You know, I'm a real life conversation guy, but
you have to call you on the phone to get your secrets.
I don't even like the phone. I like
pigeon, carrier pigeon.
Carrier pigeon, yeah, or in person. Meet at the bar. Anyway, data brokers, companies you've never heard of, are quietly collecting your home address, phone number, even your family members' names, and selling that information to anyone willing to pay. There's no opt-in, no transparency, just pure surveillance capitalism.
Yeah,
that's surveillance capital. That's a new one for me, but I already don't like it. It's an immediate no. Bad vibes.
Stay woke. Are you familiar with capitalism?
With the panopticon, it's a Michel Foucault French philosopher concept.
Did you guys know Nathaniel that Reed Silver went to University of Chicago?
We have heard of the panopticon.
He read.
I have a running joke. It wasn't a joke. It was true. I never got less than an A- on a paper when I mentioned Michel Foucault. Use that, aspiring bloggers, when you're at the University of Chicago.
This is better content than the podcast.
Truly.
Surveillance capitalism, no opt-in, no transparency, and that exposure is exactly what scammers and bad actors use to target people for identity theft and fraud. That's where Incogni comes in. They act as your personal privacy advocate, filing legal removal requests and getting your information taken down across 420-plus harmful broker sites automatically and on a recurring basis, since brokers try to relist your data every 30 to 60 days.
They won't stop.
They just keep doing it.
They're persistent.
And yet those data brokers persisted.
Persistent is a good thing when people are doing good things. When people are doing bad things like stealing your data, you don't want them to be persistent. And yet they are, Galen. And yet they are.
And Incogni's got to bat them down, bat them away.
Incogni is independently verified by Deloitte. You can track everything from their iOS or Android app. I like the iOS inclusiveness there, by the way. And if you're on the unlimited plan, the exposure scanner even hunts down your info on news sites, blogs, and forums. Bad news if you have a Substack, with a real human team handling those manual takedowns for you.
Very WWE. And manual takedowns.
I mean, takedown is a good word in a lot of contexts. And the best part, Claire?
Yeah.
Incogni offers a full 30-day money back guarantee.
Holy macaroni.
Claire, this is not a laughing matter. Reclaiming your privacy shouldn't be a luxury.
It shouldn't.
Yeah.
No, it really shouldn't.
I firmly believe that. We actually believe in this product.
Because reclaiming your privacy shouldn't be a luxury. They can't harm you if they can't find you. Use code COUNTING at Incogni.com and get 60% off an annual plan. That's Incogni.com/counting. Incogni.com/counting. Code COUNTING.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Okay.
Galen Druk with the next pick.
All right. Can I give you the phone so you can...
Okay, ready?
Hold on. Here we go.
Open it up.
Okay.
Go.
Alaska. I can see Russia from my house. Okay. So it is Mary Peltola versus Dan Sullivan. Dan Sullivan currently has a 54% chance of winning, according to the forecast. This is a very interesting race because we talked about candidate quality. Mary Peltola is an electoral juggernaut. She's outperformed Democrats in two elections, one by 9 points, another by 20 percentage points in a blue wave environment. That could mean that she could actually win here. There is a voter enfranchisement issue here, which is that there are two Dan Sullivans on the ballot. I would worry that if voters get confused and want to cast a ballot for the incumbent Republican, Dan Sullivan, and get confused that they could be disenfranchised in a way, but it is a ranked choice election.
Right.
And so hopefully those people will still be enfranchised. Nonetheless, Mary Peltola, who has rejected Kamala Harris's endorsement in this race in a way, or her fundraising plea, is separating herself from the Democratic Party, which is a smart move in a state like Alaska, and is running on Fish, Family, and Freedom for the win.
Very impressive, wow. Galen. It was like your monologue.
It's like Quiz Bowl or something.
Yeah, truly. Did you ever do a Quiz Bowl?
I did debate, which is why I talked too fast the rest of my
okay,
life.
Back to you, Claire.
Okay, I didn't do debate.
All right, here we go. 1 minute.
Okay, I've got Maine. Troy Jackson versus Susan Collins. Jackson has a win probability of 64.7%. And, I mean, have you... all I can think of is the cousin thing. Listen, Susan Collins is a high-quality candidate. She is, her ads for this race emphasize her insideriness, the power that she has for Maine. Trump, despite the fact that she voted to impeach him, Trump is still endorsing her, which I think speaks to her power within the party. Susan Collins has done something very funny, which is insinuate that Troy Jackson is married to his cousin.
Second cousin.
10 seconds. So she's basically insinuating that he's a bit weird. And he is basically trying to, that's hurtful because he's trying to introduce himself to Maine voters.
And there we have it. Again, girls, we'll come back to these. Nate.
How many fucking states do we have?
9. It was your choice to do 9.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. On the clock. 1 minute.
Kansas. And by the way, you might think that Georgia's a remaining race, but no, we actually have Kansas in Flipper as being an unlikely tipping point state, but more likely than Georgia because Ossoff seems to be in such good shape, even more than North Carolina. But yeah, Kansas. I have a lot of family in the Kansas City area. A lot of them are liberal Democrats. They've been talking to me about how you better watch Kansas. You better watch Adam Hamilton against Roger Marshall. It's at the very, very edge of feasibility. You have seen Democrats win the governorship of Kansas a couple of recent times. They have not won a Senate race in Kansas since 1932. You do have some polling.
Wow.
1932.
Longest run for Republicans.
What's the matter with Kansas?
You do have some polling. A global strategy group poll from Democrats shows their candidate up by 1 point. I think it's probably not a trick, but like a device to get fundraising. I am not sure I trust those internal polls, but you know, if you want a real wild card, Kansas is your state.
All right. And the last one here, Claire, I'll give you the timer back.
Wait, is it your turn?
Yeah, we got the final one.
Oh,
right,
yeah, I was like, okay. Ready? Okay.
All right.
You open it first. Go.
New Hampshire for a real clunker at the end. So the primary was, of course, Tuesday night. Chris Pappas, who is a member of Congress for the Democrats, won that, and John Sununu. People have generally thought of this as a pretty boring race. The Democratic win probability there is 86%.
But it has gotten close. The polling has there has been some polling showing Sununu in a tight race.
Well-known family in the state.
Yes, exactly. This is a Harris +3 state in 2024. So although it has voted recently reliably for Democrats, I don't think it's as blue as people think of at first blush. Here we have, you know, what'll be interesting here is that if you think of the motto of New Hampshire, live free or die, oh my God, 5 seconds.
Five
I was going to talk about how socialism is going to be
New Hampshire's
attacked here,
weird.
But it's not going to work very well against Chris Pappas compared with the more progressively aligned person who he beat. Also, like, he kind of ran away with that nominating.
Your time
contest.
Is up.
Sorry.
Anyway. This is the last state. Doesn't mean you get extra time.
We're done. Okay. How did that feel?
I sort of panicked.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to...
Let's clean this mess.
Yeah, oh my God. Let's clean up after ourselves. That was... We're really putting ourselves to work here for this first episode.
I know.
I would say one thing to summarize, right?
No, your minute's over, Nate.
This is overview.
The rules apply to me. Go ahead.
No, but you have kind of two categories of races. You have races that are going to follow the national picture, probably. So like North Carolina, Iowa. And then you have weird races where there are exceptions because of the electoral system, candidate quality, or both. So like Maine, Alaska, Michigan.
Yes.
Snaps. Good
snaps.
Summary.
Snaps for everybody. That was work. Okay. We're going to talk about the Republican coalition in the context of this Republican convention that is happening in Dallas as we speak. Oh, by the way, dear listener, if you are listening to this Wednesday evening or Thursday morning, you may already know some of what has happened at this convention. We're recording midday on Wednesday. So we are in the past. You are in the future. You probably have more knowledge than us already, but we're going to talk about the value of a convention. We're also going to talk about the 1 year anniversary of Charlie Kirk's assassination, also in the context of what that has meant for the Republican coalition, a unifying moment. But a lot of moments have not been so unifying for the Republican Party in the time since. So, first of all, to use a convention that past listeners may be familiar with, Claire, is this Republican convention in Dallas a good use of convention or a bad use of convention?
I would argue that all conventions are a bad use of convention because they require me to go to a convention hall and spend 5 days indoors listening to people talk. Modern conventions are essentially television programs, 3-night television programs. There's usually not really anything substantive going on. You know, there's never going to be a brokered convention. I mean, I think...
Hey.
Well, listen, actually, yeah. I mean,
there could be.
That's true. We live in that time. But, you know, like.
People said the Knicks would never win a championship.
Okay, it's fair. What I'm trying to say is conventions are basically just a time for people to pump up their voters, get people on television. And that's what, and usually there's a polling bump coming out of a convention for whatever party just convened. What Trump is trying to do here...
Good use of convened.
Thank you. I'm a writer.
What Trump is trying to do here?
What Trump is trying to do here is, first of all, he's headlining both nights of the convention, which is both expected because it's Trump, but also probably a bad idea conventionally speaking, right? Because you see what I'm doing right
You're
now?
You're so good. You're so good.
Because in these midterms, a lot of, you know, he's an unpopular president. His policies are currently unpopular. And what a lot of Republicans want to do is politely run away from him. And he is, you know, I think his theory of the case is what we were talking about earlier, is getting low propensity voters to turn out. That's kind of like their one trick with elections. And I just don't see that as it doesn't allow candidates to run a nuanced race, right? If someone wants to hold you close, let them hold you close, appear in their ad, whatever you want. It doesn't let people just sort of distance themselves because he's now going to, you know, run the news cycle for the next 3 days. So I would say bad use of convention.
Nate?
No one's going to watch this fucking thing. It's going opposite the National Football League, which is far more important to the future of this country than anything that happens in Dallas. I'm literally being serious. I could not give a fuck about this thing, right? Yes, it's dumb politically because Trump is the biggest problem that Republicans have. You don't want to showcase him. And you know, going back to the two runoffs in Georgia after 2020, I mean, Trump has been hugely problematic to Republicans trying to win the Senate. He's endorsed candidates who are poor. He maybe helped push Ken Paxton over the top in Texas this year. You know, even among Republican influencers, so to speak, people are starting to feel more iffy about Trump. That's kind of what usually happens in second terms. This thing is boring and stupid. Right? Who gives a fuck? I mean, how can you have to have something better to do? We might only have 10 years left if AI destroys the world. Don't spend a fucking night watching a fucking Republican midterm convention, for fuck's sake.
Watch football?
Absolutely. Literally.
And to be
literally,
clear,
it's,
I mean,
better for your brain to watch football.
Hashtag still counting. We will have the ratings by the next time we convene, so we will be able to tell empirically whether or not anyone listened. I just want to sort of paint a little bit of a conundrum for the Republican Party right now, which is that, again, in Trump's first term, Americans were more bullish on the economy than they were on Trump. Again, most important issue here. So a majority of Americans thought that the economy was doing well or approved of Trump's handling of the economy in his first term, whereas he was underwater. His approval rating was in the high 30s, low 40s, or worse. And so when Trump took a step back and let the economy, economic performance speak for itself, or the lack of foreign wars speak for itself, then that would kind of be helpful. So in that context, you would say, what the fuck would you be doing holding a Republican midterm convention? You should just disappear and let everybody run on whatever record they want to run on, because people feel more positive about the fundamentals in the country. In this moment, Donald Trump is more popular than his economy, right? Okay, so if you look at Silver Bulletin,
if you think about it, what a compliment.
What a compliment. So if you think about it, he's 20 percentage points underwater on just raw approval rating. The economy is net negative 28, so almost 30 percentage points. Inflation is net negative 40. So on one hand, if you're going to use that equation from the first term, you would say, well, if Trump is able to distract people from how pissed off they are about inflation and the economy, maybe it's not so bad, which gets back to what you said, Claire, of like, can he turn out those low propensity MAGA voters? And what is he going to do? How is he going to try to do that? Like, it's not just a sort of get
he's
on stage.
Call everyone, he's going to call everyone communists, right?
Exactly.
Like, that's what
exactly.
He's going to do for
right?
two
it's
days.
Remind people, and we're already seeing this with the Elon Musk sort of funded ads in Ohio and Texas about trans issues, which to your point, Nate, on the Pod Save America podcast was like, you're kind of fighting the last battle here. It's not clear that that's going to work in this new environment. All that to say, Republicans see their job here as to remind to drag Democrats down with them and not let sort of a good economy and lack of foreign war speak for itself, because people don't feel like we have a good economy and we are entangled in a foreign war.
No, there is a function. There are a lot of people who are not very enthusiastic about this midterm. A lot of them are Republicans. They're not going to vote for a Democrat. Will they vote or not? You know, Trump should be able to, like, if Republicans lose like Iowa, the benchmark we had in the first segment, like, that's a salvageable state, or should be, for
for Republicans, for example. Turek's a strong candidate. He's not a former incumbent like Sherrod Brown or something like that. So holding a line there, I'm still not sure that spotlighting Trump helps. Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably Democrats' biggest vulnerability is that they're not that popular. And as I have this shift in the primary electorate to the left, a lot of those stances aren't popular with general election voters.
Can you guess? Claire, which is more popular today, Donald Trump or the Democratic Party?
Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and you see the sort of like, quote unquote, high quality Democratic candidates are often sort of saying like they're distancing themselves from the National Party. They're playing up state issues. They're being a little bit more, you know, I'm an independent, even though there's a D next to my name.
But it kind of like the Trump second term now kind of feels a little shambolic, like kind of like a failing Broadway show where they're trying gimmicks, right? You come up on stage yourself and sing.
Is Trump running the producers?
Lake Ontario, Lake America.
A little dancing frog, maybe?
No, you had a wrestling match on. It's like a little hokey.
Give me a little shimmy. Give me a little, a couple jazz hands. Claire, what do you think? Is it going to work? Can we get a little theater criticism? Still Counting is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I gotta say, I think I've been reading ZipRecruiter ads for nigh on a decade at this point.
An OG sponsor of...
OG sponsor, and we're back. I mean, really, we've come full circle with ZipRecruiter, and I couldn't be more excited because they make hiring these days much better. In fact, it's usually very time-consuming. Nate, I know you've got your own small business. I've got my own small business. Hiring's not easy.
No, I am very meticulous about my hiring process, believe it or not. I hired both of you, kind of.
Wait, that's
the feats. The feats of strength portion was very difficult and possibly illegal.
Making us scale the walls at
the ABC building,
538 headquarters.
Nothing you wouldn't see on American Gladiators. That shows I'm dating myself, I think.
Well, the future of hiring looks much brighter, much brighter than those old school days when you hired us, Nate, because ZipRecruiter's latest tools and features help speed up finding the right people for your roles. You save valuable time, and now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/stillcounting. With ZipRecruiter's new advances, you can easily find and connect with qualified candidates in just minutes. See a candidate you're really interested in? You can unlock their contact info instantly. Over 320,000 new resumes are added to ZipRecruiter monthly, which means you can reach more potential hires and fill new roles sooner. And look, we know the data. The labor market's still tight. It's hard to find good people out there. Use ZipRecruiter and save time hiring. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidates within the first day. And if you go to ZipRecruiter.com/counting right now, you can try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/counting. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, so I think we are coalescing around this Republican midterm convention being a bad use of convention. Fair enough. By the next time we meet, we will have sort of numbers as to whether or not people paid attention and whether or not Trump's approval rating went up or the generic ballot tightened or whatever, all that jazz. I want to move on, though, to a tougher topic, which is that we are at the first anniversary of Charlie Kirk's assassination. I am sure this is going to be a theme or one of the themes of the convention as it's happening at the same time as that anniversary. This was a moment of party unity and a lot of sort of frustration and fear for the Republican Party, especially after multiple assassination attempts against Donald Trump, the assassination of Charlie Kirk. The Republican Party has been has had a topsy-turvy year in terms of, you know, sentiment about sort of how much the coalition has held together. But at least a year ago, it felt like there was a lot of unity. And also, so we can talk about that. But I also want to talk about this first and foremost from the perspective of political violence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, we can get into the numbers. But at the very least, if you look at the polling, Americans feel like political violence is increasingly a problem in this country. I mean, Nate was supposed to speak on a college campus the day after the assassination.
I did, yeah. It was like a day or two after. Because I'm trying to read what I wrote. Being a blogger, one nice thing is you're not allowed to like invent your reaction to something when you actually reacted to it in real time. And I waited a couple of days because like it did hit emotionally. Like Charlie Kruger is a prominent political figure who gives talks in college campuses. I'm probably not as prominent, but like I get hate mail and things like that. But the
first
story,
how many times has The Onion tried to kill you?
Me, yeah. The first story I wrote was kind of annoyance, phrased more elegantly than annoyance, right? But like it's like, why does everyone have to have a fucking take about this, right? This terrible thing happened. It's frightening. How do we prevent it from happening again? Why do you have to fucking take everybody, right? And then a few days later, I wrote, the political mood feels like September 11th again, meaning that like it felt like, you know, I mean, I guess I'm older than you two. I remember like my first job out of college, you would go to like facilities and you'd have like the security threat levels and things like that. But a year later, that 9/11 feeling of the combination of unity, but also kind of weaponized unity, like that.
It's faded.
That take feels wrong, right? That story lasted for about 2 weeks and then fades into the background. And by the way, you know, you also had an assassination attempt against the president at the White House Correspondents' Dinner this year. That kind of fades into the background. You had an arson at Josh Shapiro's house. You had a kidnapping plot against Gretchen Whitmer. You had the congressional softball shooting, right?
I mean,
you had
also,
Nancy Pelosi house attack. All these things. Sam Altman was the target of vigilante violence.
Like recently, our producers put together a timeline of some of the political violence that the country has experienced over the past couple years. And like, it made me feel sad reading. I mean, sad for the country, but it made me feel sad how much of what was in the timeline that I didn't remember. So, you know, United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson is fatally, that happened in 2024. I remember that.
No, it didn't. Brian Thompson, that happened in 2025, right?
December of 2024.
Wow. Wow. That's really, I guess, it happened right after the election.
I did not remember, you know, the Minnesota House of Representatives Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and her husband were killed last year in 2025 as well. And Charlie Kirk and these assassination attempts, and as you mentioned, the arson at Josh Shapiro's house. Also, I mean, this is like very different, but created this environment where people were having reactions to politically centered violence, like the killing of Renee Good and Alex Pretty and the clashes in Minnesota. And it's just like, the way that I almost didn't remember the amount of like high profile violence over the past year and a half.
And January 6th, and you had peaceful protest and riots in 2020, let's be clear. Right?
Yeah, the past year has been, I mean, just to take the Kirk shooting felt, I think it was amplified by the political media class feeling like, you know, all of us are on social media, everyone worries about their families. That felt very frightening, where it's like we are now 10 years into super hardcore polarization. I mean, listen, we used to be on a mainstream news network, and now we are a journalistic podcast that has no political affiliation, but we're on a left-leaning network, right? That speaks to the partisan nature of the country itself. But I think just like the violence associated with that, the fact that it's, you know, people like flock cameras and AI I brought up earlier, like people are really worried about these sort of existential things. And so I think that the Kirk killing was certainly amplified by a political class that felt personally very frightened. And then I think this past year of, the killings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty and others, right? Like, I think we also forget like people who are dying in ICE custody. There have been a lot of sort of really disturbing stories about children in detainment centers. I think there was a little bit of not just sort of the political violence angle of it, but the number of times that we were reading about deaths in the context of U.S. government actions was out of the norm. And I don't think, and I think Republicans felt that too, right? That is a thing that was sort of a death-soaked year in a way that felt very, you know, the political violence of it felt very like 1960s. I mean, we talk about that a lot, but it's now, I think we kind of can't deny that we now live in an era of political violence. And I think a little disturbingly, and I'll stop in a second, that we live in an era where because of that hardcore partisanship, because of infighting within both parties, there isn't a lot of clear moral leadership, right? Like, who do people listen to, right? Like, that's a that's the thing I've been thinking a lot about, because a lot of, you know, you can have voices in the party saying, please don't amplify this. Please, like, let's all call for calm. But America actually has a little bit of a moral vacuum problem. I think it's one of the reasons, I mean, this takes seriously. When the astronauts were up in space, everyone loved the astronaut content because they were like, I mean, they literally are like the best and brightest, but they were also being philosophical and religious and like, and or like the Pope, right? I mean, obviously the Pope is now a partisan figure too in America because that's what we do. But there was this sort of sense, I think, of like, well, we need like some bright spots. And I think about that as sort of like this vague America's moral code kind of rattling around.
I think that's very real. And I think back to the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's assassination and like the degree to which it was treated in at least amongst online communities, which again is so not real life, but like as a point for sort of jokes and like a debate over whether or not like Charlie Kirk was a good guy or it was justified or whatever on the left. And like, where is the moral authority to say?
But then
like,
people were also getting fired for posting like, things, which is also.
And then a more like authoritarian impulse on the right that's like, no, this kind of speech is unacceptable. I want to put some numbers to this to be like that guy. Because I think this encapsulates, we've been talking a lot about a feeling, and I think that these numbers from the U.S. Capitol Police sort of encapsulate something, and I'll quote from their numbers that were released at the beginning of 2026. The number of United States Capitol Police threat assessment cases has climbed for the third year in a row. In 2025, the U.S. Capitol Police investigated almost 15,000 concerning statements, behaviors, and communications directed against members of Congress, their families, staff, and the Capitol complex. That is a 58% rise in threats against members of Congress from the year prior in 2024.
And by the way, I believe that the Supreme Court asked for a budget increase this year because, like, almost purely because they want more security.
And from also, like, a rigorous perspective, we know, you said, like, who's the moral authority? When you ask Americans, like, is political violence acceptable, you get sometimes numbers as high as, like, 30% or so, 20, 30% or so. That polling, we should take that with a lot of skepticism. You know, it's people maybe answering in abstract ways off the cuff. When you get down into the specifics of like, do you think a specific act of violence is justified, like a killing, a property destruction, whatever, the percentage of Americans who say that it is justified is in the single digits. It's like 4% or lower. I mean, when we're getting into talk of real sort of harm to individuals, maybe say as low as 1% or 2%. Bad news is, in a country of 340 million people, that is still far too many people who endorse the use of violence in politics. But what we do know about how to get that number lower and how to make people understand that political violence is never acceptable is it requires the political leaders from which they take cues. And so if we don't feel like either of the parties have a clear moral authority and there is this kind of breakdown and intra-party fighting and like no one, it doesn't really feel like.
But it's also, you know, the thing, I can't find the number right now in the document, but it the United Healthcare killing was like broadly Americans said that kind of assassination is immoral. But for people under, let's just find the number.
Yeah, I got the number for you.
But yeah, so this is an Emerson College poll, and the majority of voters, 68%, by far, right, said that the actions of the killer were unacceptable. But 41% of voters between the age of 18 and 29 found that killing to be acceptable. And I, you know, it's such a, interesting is the wrong word, right? But I think that vigilante killing because of a healthcare, because of a problem with the healthcare system, which I think, like, again, going to the political ads, right? Everyone hates insurance companies, right? Everyone loved Dolly Parton and everyone hates insurance companies. But I think that the direction that younger Americans are going to is on both sides. Like there have been a lot of really interesting pieces about sort of like the hardcore, like quasi-fascist, anti-Semitic things of like college Republican clubs, right? Like, you know, or the more extreme Nick Fuentes-y. And I think that just speaks to go to like, you know, the September 11th of it all. The past 25 years of American life have been there have been profound shifts. I mean, I graduated in 2009 in the middle of an economic crisis, right? There, with the 9/11 generation is coming of age, and they are dealing with a society that they are right in some macro sense that there is something deeply there are deep inequities. There are deep problems with our political system. I mean, like, if you are 18 years old and about to vote in this election, you have only known the Trump era as the kind of discourse. And I do find that disturbing, right? So those numbers I think the killing was reprehensible, but that speaks to people having these frustrated ideas about, like, how do we even fix the fuck-uppery of the American system on a number of levels.
It's also, I mean, I would say, I guess as the elder statements
as the Gen X
podcast.
Yeah.
As the only Gen Xer at the table.
As the only Gen Xer. The 1960s, the 1970s were profoundly more violent than we have mm-hmm. right now. You know, I think that's worth keeping some things in perspective.
Were there school shootings? I mean, like, I think you can, like, politically violent, maybe, but, like, I also think that we live actually in a quite, I mean, like, people who have school-age children.
I mean, a lot more people were murdered.
Okay.
Say something nice about America. The murder rate is way down, historically low.
A lot more people were killed because of unsafe working conditions and car accidents and things like that. But, and, like, I'm not a big privileger of certain types of deaths, I guess. Of course, if you cover politics and everywhere.
But it's inarguable that a violent death or well-publicized death in that way is different.
It's tricky to de-amplify things, right? Let's not take Charlie Kirk, because Charlie Kirk is a political figure, journalist, whatever you want to call him, right? When there is an act of terror and the primary purpose of the act of terror is to make people fear, you know, and there's evidence that oftentimes terrorist attacks, school shootings, things like that have a copycat effect where the more you publicize it, you know, the more incentive there is for someone to try to be the next whatever that gets a movie made about him. To say, I don't think we should be talking about this as much, right? That's very hard to do because you'd be like, are you being insensitive? And if you say that, then you actually, it's hard to say the unstated, you know, you amplify it. And this was particularly true for
this whole segment.
Yeah, I mean,
part of the reason I wanted to have this little half segment on Kirk is because, like, it is interesting looking back a year later how it felt, because I would have thought it would have more lingering effects than it did. And the fact that, frankly, Moit and I have remembered it until we have these weekly meetings to think about every possible story we can cover, like, that seemed like a change. I just wanted to take that.
Yeah. Note that feels like different. It speaks to, you know, the multiple-tabbed browsing brain, the Twitter brain that we all have. Like, it is actually a problem that none of us can remember what happened 12 months ago. And I mean that societally, right? Like, in the whole, way too used history repeats itself. Like, the fact that people don't have any lingering sense of...
The president was shot, or the president, presidential candidate, former President Trump and now current president was shot in a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. Was it June or July 2024? July 24. You know, you can easily tell a story where that was a pivotal event in the election. His favorability ratings went up. Joe Biden exited the race shortly after that. And, like, that's kind of not remembered. Well, maybe it should be. Like, if you remember, you know, the first thing I remember about 2024 is the chaos over Biden, right? But we had a presidential candidate come within millimeters of being killed or seriously injured, and, like, you know, shouldn't that have been the...
It was. I think we talked about this a little bit in the meeting the other day where we were, you know, Butler is such an interesting, shocking moment. Trump's even reaction in the moment, right? Whatever you can say about the guy, he knows how an image or a visual will work. And so when he raised his hand and then it sort of became a thing, and then Elon Musk was like... That was when he came out to say, I'm for Trump. It's when Bobby Kennedy first reached out to him. And that was when the talks happened and eventually led to him endorsing. So it was this kind of maybe we can't specifically tie numbers to that assassination, but it had a profound psychological impact of moving people towards consolidating behind Trump.
And what strikes me a year after Charlie Kirk's assassination is that didn't happen. in the same way for the Republican Party. It is much harder to be the party in power and deal with all of the infighting and responsibility that that brings. But, and this is very much a conversation for another day. I think we should talk about how sort of consolidated the Republican or the Trump coalition is, because it very quickly devolved into conversation within the Republican Party about Epstein and the war in Iran and sort of disappointments with Trump and that whole thing. And I think this will be a reminder for Republicans about that sense of unity that they had. But I think I'll cast forward to future episodes. We'll talk about this.
And just to add one more thing, I think, about what the Kirk assassination and the months after it said about Republicans, I think, you know, there was at first this outpouring and unity. And then I think some of the traits that have defined the modern Republican Party really came out in full force, namely
conspiracy theories,
right? Very prominently led by Candace Owens, who I profiled her for The New Yorker a couple of years ago. I mean, she was sort of talent scouted by Kirk. And then she did this quite, I mean, grotesque turn on him and his, it was just a very strange series of weeks. And then people started talking about, you know, conspiracy theories about Charlie Kirk and Israel. And, you know, there were all these things that really, I think, exemplified how the Republican Party deals with it, sort of ending up with like the Epstein transparency stuff, which you're right. It's too much to get into right now.
Well, guys, we've had some highs and some lows this first episode alone. If this is any indication of the roller coaster ride of fun, seriousness, numbers, emotion that we are going to have on this podcast, I think folks are in for a ride. No, it'll be fun, but it will also be information worth knowing about and worth thinking about. And so, Nate and Claire, I want to thank you so much for going on this roller coaster ride with me today.
Thank you.
Because we're still counting.
I'm not participating in that.
That's it for today's episode of Still Counting. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe on YouTube, where, of course, you can see us in action, our pretty faces, all of this lighting, all of the sort of my gesticulation. I speak with my hands too much as I'm learning from this project. But anyway, subscribe on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast. We are going to be back next Wednesday evening with the next installment of Still Counting. Until then, thanks for listening. Still Counting is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Saul Rubin. Our music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Our production team includes Reed Trillin, Johanna Case, and Ben Hethcote. Production support from Matt DeGroat, Katie Long, and Adrian Hill. Our production staff is proudly unionized with Writers Guild of America East.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just $10.
$10 for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.